Upon the death of Wellington, Queen Victoria proclaimed that he was the greatest man the country ever produced. He died on the 14th September, 1852. An embalming must have taken place, for the funeral was long deferred. The body was removed from Warmer Castle on the 11th of November to Chelsea Hospital, that in its hall there might be the lying in state. I lived in Chelsea at the time, so that local interest was added to the excitement. I remember being shocked to learn that five persons were crushed to death at the gates of the hospital. Owing to the enormous crowd, described at the time as follows. The actual words were, "The multitude actually smoked like a heated haystack from the pressure and strain upon individuals." With the object of our seeing everything, my brother and I were entrusted to an uncle that he might take us to see the lying in state. The police had then taken precautions to prevent further fatalities, and their directions were that the intending sightseers should enter from the King's Road, Chelsea, the open gravel space in the centre of Royal Avenue, as it is now called, leading to Burton Court, and thence to the cupola of the hospital, the hall where the solemn spectacle took place being to the right. We were formed into groups of about 50 people each, at intervals of about 10 yards, these extending the whole quarter of a mile of the route. From time to time, as progress was made, all these groups in close formation were allowed to shuffle forward the distance to be gained. I do not know what time this penitential, purgatorial pilgrimage occupied, but the flow must have been fairly rapid, as on the last 3 days of the spectacle, 50,000, 60,000, and 63,000 respectively passed through the hall. I was not sorry that in a short time our uncle thought that our attaining our object in a reasonable time was hopeless, and therefore withdrew us from the fetid group into which we had been shepherded. To view the funeral procession, seats had been secured in a shop in Fleet Street, where the law courts now stand, a few doors west of Temple Bar, which was decorated, as I thought, very beautifully. My parents seemed to have been affected by that feverish anxiety as to reaching the ceremonial in time. The result being that on the vital morning of the 18th of November, I was aroused from my bed by candlelight. This gas was not laid on until some years after. To reach Fleet Street, we adopted our usual means of locomotion to the city, by steamboat from the Cadogan Pier, disembarking at the Temple. Contrary to expectation, there was no crowd, so that we made the voyage in comfort. There is no doubt that in its impressive an elaborate pageantry, the funeral of the Duke of Wellington would vie with any which has taken place before or since. It was attended by royalty in the person of Prince Albert and by distinguished persons, both English and foreign. Naturally, the impression which such spectacular splendour made upon my mind was passed away, but the appearance of the funeral car, so appropriately caparisoned with a hero's hat and sword on the coffin, gave me great delight. It was drawn by 12 horses and weighed 12 tons. What necessity there was for so heavy an equipage, it is difficult to understand. The presence in the procession of 83 Chelsea pensioners, the number corresponding with the age and years of the Duke, pleased me much, as seeing them daily in the Chelsea streets, I looked upon them as old friends. My mother remarked upon their tired appearance, which was owing, no doubt, to their having walked from Chelsea. There being too, one may assume, as is customary in military diversions, hours of unnecessary standing about. The majority, if not all, may have beheld the Duke when commanding in India, the Peninsula, or at Waterloo. After the lamentable loss of life at the lying in state, the police were keen to avoid a similar calamity. As if eager to follow the procession, an enormous crowd appeared on the south side of St. Clement Danes Church. There was no embankment in those days, and possibly it was feared that as there was no outlet, the crowd would be congested at the bottleneck of Temple Bar. I remember that the police closed up across the road and belaboured the crowd with their truncheons, the result being that under the warmth of this reception, it soon melted away.
I remember a bare and shabby room. It was old Deuxième, in an old building in the Quartier Panthéon. The house was still stately, with small balconies at each window, and the inevitable jalousies. A thin, grey-haired woman was frying something over a wood fire, turning it over carefully every few minutes. I asked, "What's that you're cooking, grand-mère? I don't like the smell of it much." It was quite an event that anything was being cooked in those days. There was another woman in the room looking out of the window. She was my mother. My father had died when I was 2 years old. She turned round hastily and said, "Don't tell her what it is, mother. It's just as well you shouldn't know." "Oh, grandma," I wailed, "whatever it is, do hurry up. I'm so hungry." "Yes, I know you are, dear. There's a bit of bread to go on with, but eat it very slowly. There's so little left." That bread, so cold, was quite black. I kept a piece of it for many years till it crumbled away. All the children and the old men and women left in the besieged city were hungry, desperately hungry. They cried out, "J'ai faim. Oh, mon Dieu, que j'ai faim." Afterwards, I knew what we had eaten that day, rats from the great Paris sewers. I was told, too, that my mother and her friends stood day after day in the long queues to buy those rats and a small portion of black bread. There was nothing else to be had. All cats and dogs had been killed for food. There were often wild scenes outside the few shops that were open when the famished crowd feared they would get nothing, so it was well that my mother had a friend with her. This was Monsieur Labouchere, afterwards a Member of Parliament and the founder and editor of Truth. I suppose my hunger was partially satisfied by those grilled rats which had been cooked by the wood fire, wood from the banisters outside. There was little enough left even of those banisters, as other tenants in the house had been using the wood freely. How dangerous those steps must have been, especially for a child. Of course, there was no coal to be had in Paris. There was a stationery and a newspaper shop opposite us. Newspapers were no longer issued, only loose sheets of the latest bulletin of the fighting, depressing news always. I used to watch the crowd gathering round Monsieur Dupont's shop and the hour when those loose sheets were given out. The poor man had to barricade the door as well as the windows, leaving only a small opening through which to pass the leaflets to the outstretched hands outside. Old men, I remember, would throw them furiously on the pavement and stamp on them, but the women would either push their way out of the crowd with white, stony faces or weeping bitterly. I've often wondered since, had those people any hope left? Communication with the outside world was entirely cut off. There was only the pigeon post left. My mother took me one day to the queer depot in which the pigeons were kept. She wanted to send a reassuring message to my grandfather. He had been held up in Calais as he was trying to reach Paris. I was thrilled with the sight of the birds in their crates and cages. I asked, couldn't we buy just one, Mama? Grandmère could cook it for dinner. Just one, please. A girl child's natural fondness for gentle living things, like birds and kittens, was submerged by hunger in those days. Hunger and cold, too. We were always cold. Only at night we had a little warmth when we huddled together under blankets. Sheets were things of the past. All household linen and cotton stuffs were taken to the overcrowded hospitals to be used as lint and bandages for the wounded. Everyone made lint, old men and children too. I myself made a good pile each day. At last, the day of capitulation arrived, January the 18th, 1871.
The whole thing was, and had to be, a game of bluff, from start to finish. It was not what you'd call a proper military feat of arms, but just a minor episode in the course of the greater campaign. Just before the war began, I had telegraphed to headquarters at the Cape to say that we must have some good artillery if we were to hold the place. The answer came, in code language, that two 4.7 guns were being sent up by the next train. This glad news was published, and no doubt went to the Boers also, and the garrison flocked down to the station to meet the two monster guns that were going to make our attackers sit up. When the train rolled in, there was no outward sign of these guns. I asked the guard, "Where are our guns that you're going to brought up?" "Oh, yes, sir, I've got them in my van." And there they were, two little 9-pounder guns, and old ones at that. One of the men who'd served with me in Matabeleland 3 years previously recognized them. "Why," he said, "blowed if that isn't old crooked-tailed Sal, a gun we had used in Rhodesia with a badly damaged trail." In telling me to expect the big guns, the wrong code word had been used, and instead of 9-pounder, they had used the word for 4.7, a very different pair of shoes. But the report had got out that we had the big guns. You see, up till the actual outbreak of war, we had lots of spies in the place, and we gave them something to report. For instance, we laid explosive mines all round the place. They were contained in small boxes and were made up by an expert in a certain building and were then carried with the greatest care by natives who were warned against the disastrous explosion that would follow if they should drop one of them. These boxes were carefully buried at different points round the front of the town, and wires were laid connecting them with the central observation post. Notices were posted in English and Dutch, warning the inhabitants that if they allowed their cattle or children to wander there, it would be at their own risk. We gave notice that on a certain day, trial would be made with one or more of the mines to see that they were in working order. So people were warned to keep clear of the east front between 12 and 2. Between 12 and 2, with everybody safe indoors, Major Panzera and I crept out and stuck a stick of dynamite into an old Aunt Bear hole. We lit the fuse, ran like fun, and took cover until the thing went off, which it did, with a splendid roar and a vast cloud of dust. Out of the dust emerged a man with a bike, who happened to be passing, and he pedaled off as hard as he could go for the Transvaal, about 8 miles away, where no doubt he told how, by merely riding along the road, he had hit off a murderous mine. I may explain that the only dynamite we had was the one stick of it that we had used for our experiment, and the boxes were actually filled with nothing more dangerous than sand. One thing that put Mafeking overmuch in the limelight at home during the early days of the siege was that we sent out exuberantly cheerful messages to Lord Roberts, our commander-in-chief. He was anxious to know how we were getting on, and to show him that all was well, we sent such messages. But it was also done for another reason. The messages were carried by native runners who had to creep through the Boer lines at night. And in the event of their being captured, our messages were read by the enemy. And so these would not be at all encouraging to them. We never thought that the messages would then be sent on to England. As it was, they arrived there just at a time when our forces in other parts of South Africa were suffering some nasty setbacks at the hands of the Boers. So anything that relieved the gloom set up by these was welcomed at home just then with exaggerated joy. We had around Mafeking at first some 10 to 12,000 Boers under General Cronje, and another strong force was engaged up north against Plumer's column at Thule. So in order to get more of them, if possible, busy up here and away from the southern ports, I wrote a letter to an Englishman who had settled within the Transvaal border north of Mafeking. I knew, as a matter of fact, he had died, and that therefore the letter would be opened by the post office people. So I wrote as if from some friend of his, telling him that a secret British force was going to make a raid into the Transvaal, passing close by his farm. But this was a dead secret, and he must not tell a soul about it. Consequence was, a column of some 1,200 Boers went to the place and stayed there a long time waiting for this secret force. I met their commandant a year or two later and heard all about it from him. In the middle of his yarn, he looked at me suspiciously and suddenly asked, "Did you write that letter?" And when I modestly admitted that I had, he shook hands and congratulated me on being a very successful, well, bluffer. We beat off a good number of attacks in daylight, but I was always afraid they might get us with a night attack, as they easily could have done. To discourage this, we started searchlights. Again, a bluff. We only had one, and that was a tin cowl made out of a biscuit tin with a strong acetylene lamp inside it. This was mounted on the top of a pole, the foot of which stood on the ground, so it was held upright by one man who could then turn it round and send its ray round the front. We only had a very small supply of acetylene and just this one lamp. But that one lamp did yeoman duty. No sooner had it done a display in one fort than it was rushed off to a different one and showed a few flashes there. Next night, it blazed up in quite another part of the defences. And thus, we spread an impression that any night attack would be exposed to a perfect blaze of searchlights everywhere. Crooked Tail's cell, as well as our other elderly guns, was not much use to us. And so we manufactured a gun for ourselves. We took the steam pipe of an engine, and this was reinforced with some iron railings melted down and shrunk onto it. A brass trunnion and breech were cast and shrunk on, and the whole contraption was mounted on the wheels of an old thrashing machine. My name among the natives was Impisa, the wolf, meaning the beast that doesn't sleep at night. So this gun was christened the Wolf, because it was chiefly to be used at night. You see, with homemade powder and shot, the Wolf did not carry so very far. So in order to make up for this, we used to move it out in the night as silently as we could, with its wheels wrapped up in canvas and straw, till we got within range of the enemy's camp. Then we hung up blankets all round it so that the flash would not be very visible. Then we loosed off our shots as fast as we could and then lay low while the enemy spent the rest of the night firing vaguely at where they thought we were, which was generally where we were not.
When I was first married, there was a delightful custom then that the first year you were married, everyone you knew came to call on you and leave their cards on you. And then they invited us out to dinner, and because I was a bride, I was to wear my wedding dress, and the host took me into dinner. Whatever grand and important people were there, he took the bride into dinner. And Lord Ducie was a friend of Father's, who was a scientist. He asked me to dinner, and I was taken into dinner by Lord Kelvin. And he was charming and interesting. And then during dinner, he turned to me and he said, "What do you think I've got in my pocket?" I said, "What?" He said, "A little bit of the very first radium that was ever discovered, which Madame Curie sent me." He said, "Madame Curie is a very good friend of mine, and I'm so thrilled to have this, and I'll show it to you after dinner." So after dinner, we all went up to the drawing room. He produced a little ordinary matchbox out of his pocket. He said, "Now turn out the electric light." It was one of the few houses that had already got electric light. And here was a little thing shining blue, a little tiny atom shining bright blue. He dropped it on the floor, but it was quite easy to retrieve it because it was shining. And there he had it in an ordinary matchbox in his pocket and never knew how dangerous it was.
I suppose most excavators would confess to a feeling of awe, almost embarrassment, when they break into a tomb closed and sealed by pious hands so many centuries ago. 33 centuries had passed since human feet last trod the floor on which we stood, and yet the signs of recent life were around us. A half-filled bowl of mortar, a blackened lamp, the chips of wood left on the floor by a careless carpenter. We had penetrated two chambers, but when we came to a golden shrine with doors closed and sealed, we realized that we were in the presence of the dead king. We were to witness a spectacle such as no other man in our times had been privileged to see. I carefully cut the cord, removed the pressure seal, drew back the bolts, and opened the doors. When a second shrine was revealed, even more brilliant in workmanship than the last. With intense excitement, I went forward and unbolted the inner doors. They slowly swung open. And there, filling the entire area within, stood an immense yellow quartzite sarcophagus. It effectually barred any further progress until we could raise the lid. Then a decisive moment. None of us but felt the solemnity of the occasion. In a dead silence, the huge lid, weighing over a ton and a quarter, was raised from its bed. Light shone into the sarcophagus. But how disappointing. The contents were completely covered by linen shrouds. But as the last shroud was rolled back, a gasp of wonderment escaped our lips. So gorgeous was the sight that met our eyes. A golden effigy of the young king of magnificent workmanship filled the whole of the interior. This was but the lid of a series of three coffins nested one within the other, enclosing the mortal remains of the young king Tutankhamun. Laid on that golden outer lid was a tiny wreath of flowers, as it pleased us to think, the last farewell offering of the widowed girl queen to her husband. Among all that regal splendor, everywhere the glint of gold. There was nothing so beautiful as those few withered flowers. They told us what a short period 3,300 years really was. But yesterday and the morrow.